On the move. Good people. Welcome back. This is Mike Africa Jr. and this is my podcast where we illuminate the struggles of the people, inform the uninformed, and give you nothing but the truth. On the Move is here to disrupt the system and spark a global revolutionary change. Change is going to come, like Sam Cooke said, but like Gandhi said, you got to be the change you want to see in the world. And even though Gandhi wasn't perfect, he said something that was true. And when the power of truth is present, you better respect it, because the power of truth is final.
Hey.
The topic of discussion for today is white people and black movements. To help me with this topic that I get asked to talk about a lot, she's been here before. She's a core organizer for Black Lives Matter Philly and the Black Philly Radical Collective. She is also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the Graduate School of Education, where her research and teaching focuses on student and community activism, global Black youth cultures, and the role of schools and sites of political struggles. She is Dr. Crystal Strong.
Hey, on the move.
My other guest is also a core organizer for Black Lives Matter Philly and the Black Alliance for Peace. She has also helped launch the Black Philly Radical Collective. She is a liberator with Ubuntu Freedom and chief visionary officer of Deep Blue Woman Company, through which Black and Native femme frontline organizers consult with and tighten up organizations, groups, and individuals using a liberation lens. She is the one and only Yane Indigo.
That's me, and that's an old bio.
What?
It is.
Y'all, you know what?
But that's okay, because we're going to rock with it.
Well, it was true at one time, at least.
It absolutely was.
What happened?
Life happened.
Life happened. Yeah. Things shifted, things
progress
got moved around.
Progress happened. You know, you got to move forward on the path of your purpose, and sometimes some things move, they get left behind.
Well, I was going to ask y'all how y'all doing, but I already see how y'all doing.
How is that?
Correcting a wrong. That's how y'all doing. That's how y'all do. That's what y'all do. That's what we do.
In that spirit.
Okay.
You know what? I'm going to hold it.
Wait, hold up. In that spirit, come on.
All right. So you said our topic is white people in black movements.
Yeah.
Do you mean white people?
What I say?
Or do you mean non-black people?
When I say white people, I mean, wait a minute. We got to come back to this. Hold on. I got a program here that I'm trying to make sure that this thing is all in order so it sounds right to the listeners. So we do have a big topic. But first, we got to do Gimme Two. Listen, activists are multifaceted. And oftentimes, people don't think of us as doing anything other than rallying and protesting. And Gimme Two is a way to spotlight those other good things that we got going on in our lives. So before we get into the heavy stuff, let's talk about some fun stuff. Okay? Can we do that?
Yes.
Okay. First thing I want to start with is Robin and I had a getaway. We did a little weekend getaway. And one of the things that we did on this getaway was we went to Houston, Texas, where I met up with a cousin of mine who in the last maybe 2 decades, I only saw maybe 3 or 4 times. And in the house when we grew up, we were like brothers. We were closer than cousins. We were like brothers, right? And so like to not see him in so long, and then to reconnect with him, and then hear his kids call me by my name, my nickname, the name we grew up with, and them say it correctly. It felt good, because I knew by that he was telling them things about me, and enough where they actually said, oh, that's him? And they were like excited to see me. So that was one thing that made me feel kind of good. The other thing is I did something that was really cool. My buddy Tommy Oliver, as you guys met Tommy.
Yes.
He hooked me up. He's like, hey, Mike, I'm in wherever he was. And he's like, I want to do this thing. I want you to come and act on this movie that I'm working on. So he called me out. I went out to New York and we did this. I did this acting thing with an A-list actor.
Hey.
Yeah, I was pretty excited about it. It was a lot of fun. I got a chance to meet a lot of people. I don't expect to be in this thing. I'm not an actor, right? But the chance to like talk to some people and like make some people aware of these things that I experienced, you know, and bring it to a bigger stage than it already was on, is always a good thing.
Yeah.
So that was the other thing I did.
That's so.
So now Crystal, you've been here more recently, so Yane, give me two.
First thing I'll say is I'll start with family. Like the first thing is just family in general, that I think there's been like such cool things happening with my family. I've been having a hangout with my mom every Thursday. So we have a mommy and me day.
Oh, nice.
Every Thursday. And so I go and grab my mom and we roll around and do things all over the, just do different things. So, you know, we do, you know, we have that. You know, my niece just turned 30 yesterday, so that's exciting. My daughter's doing some awesome things and just sent me some amazing pictures of a photo shoot she just did. So I just, the things going on with my immediate family, you know, my niece Sierra is just amazing. And so I just, that's one thing. And okay. Then the other thing would be that I got to add a new addition to my family.
Okay.
And
Wait, you had a baby?
Well, I have a baby dog.
Okay.
A puppy. I just added to my household.
I saw her.
Named Vision.
I saw Vision today. And for the people out there who cannot see her, she is beautiful.
Adorable.
So far, she's in the office, in the studio. She's very well behaved. She's just doing her puppy thing. She's relaxing. And she didn't do anything that... I would have to clean up later. So right now, Vision is a winner.
Yes, yes. And I won because I got all of that around me.
There you go.
Those are my two.
Talk to me, Chris.
I just want to say that I voted for a different name for the puppy.
Wait a minute. Hold up. I think Chris is trying to call dibs on naming Yane's puppy.
No, I wasn't trying to call dibs. I just am saying I had a different vision for Vision.
Vision. What was your vision?
The puppy formerly known as blank. One of the options, Yane shared with me like 6 or 7 puppy name options. And one of the options that I thought was very sweet was Comfort.
Oh, wow.
I thought that was very sweet.
Okay. But she got Vision.
But she got Vision.
Okay.
I'm not mad at Vision.
So if you get a puppy, guess what? You got a name already.
No. It was very specific to this dog this circumstance.
So give me your twos.
My twos. Okay. The biggest one is that I also went on a couple's getaway. And it was for a very special occasion, anniversary.
Oh, nice.
We went to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, which is, my family's from like 45 minutes outside of Myrtle Beach. Mm. And so that was super dope. I mean, that was my first time traveling, like since we've been in a panty.
Ah.
That is a pandemic. The Panasonic. And so... that was cool. Like, it was cool to sit on the beach, to be in the water, to, like, reconnect outside of the same four walls. Mm-hmm. And so that was lovely. And then the other thing is actually related to an experience I had in Myrtle Beach.
Okay.
We checked out of the hotel in the morning, and our flight wasn't until the evening. And so we had to figure out, like, what to do with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we rented a golf cart.
Uh-huh.
And I was behind the wheel.
Okay. Were you like a...
Yeah.
Like a...
I was whipping it.
You was whipping the golf cart.
Skirt on 22s.
Skirting on 22s. That's what I'm talking about.
And, you know, I love cruising, actually. Like, I love whether it's on a bike, whether it's on a golf cart, the wind in your hair. And so we were just cruising around the shoreline. And that was just... it was a very freeing experience after feeling like contained all these months. So those are my two.
Did you go on a golf course with the golf cart?
No, we just, you just, can, like, people rent
golf carts.
Golf carts.
You just skirt on 22s.
And you just skirt. And I was skirt
on 22s. I like it. Nice. Nice. So now we're going to get into this topic.
All right.
There's something that caught my eye the other day. We're well over the 1 year mark since the 2020 uprisings, the George Floyd, the Breonna Taylors, and all of that. And I know that y'all were deep into that whole time, and I know that because we were in that
time together.
We were rolling.
In the time together. And I got to say, too, like, this is not a real comfortable conversation for me to have. We're talking about white people in black movements, black spaces. And believe it or not, and I'm not saying this just to be funny, but probably one of my best friends are white. So it's really interesting. Something that a lot of journalists have been reporting on and commenting on is this like wave of non-black people that came on, like, they came with resources, they came with support, they came with protest signs, and they were all over the place. You had Black Lives Matter signs on lawns in the suburbs and Cherry Hill and all over, right? But right now it looks like that wave has receded a lot. And the ships have sailed.
The slave ships? Like, what kind of ships? The yachts? They came in on?
So I guess what I'm getting at with this is people donate, right? They support it. They put a lot of money into this thing. And I guess it's kind of like, it makes me think of the term, it's not enough to be not racist. You have to be anti-racist, right? So, Yane.
Yeah.
I know if anybody knows about this topic, you do. It's a sensitive topic for a lot of people because we have a lot of non-black people supporting these movements. But there is something that happens and it ends, it dries up for a lot of people. Some stick around, but what's going on with what are these journalists talking about and with this about this wave? What's going on with that?
Well, I don't know anything about the journalists and what they're talking about, but I can speak to what I've observed as it relates to like the larger group of, like, when they have these mass numbers of white people joining these spaces. And actually, even though it wasn't a black space, an example that I think of was when I was at Standing Rock, because at Standing Rock, you had like these people who were indigenous to that land there, who were having a fight, and people came to join that fight. And there were people from the Black Liberation Movement, a lot of people who came to join that fight and left the fights that we were in to join that fight. And then you had a lot of white people that came and other people as well. And there was a really stark difference in how they engaged in that fight. And mm-hmm. I think that difference really speaks to some of what we may be experiencing in some of these other environments, because when the black people came into the space, we are people who already know what it's like to have people come in and like take over your space and roll and take resources as a result of having been in your space, or try to take over your space and don't know what your struggle is. And we came in with humility, and we came in really, even when we were frustrated, even when we observed things that were like, you don't know what you're doing on this particular thing. Like, this is something we know about. We're here. We could help you, but you don't want to hear from us. So we fell back. We followed. Okay. Sometimes they did not want to hear from us. That's a whole nother thing. But the white people came in and they was taking over, building without permission and knocking things down, creating conflict when it didn't have to be, creating conflict that they would then leave, and the people who they were supposed to be coming there to fight on the to fight beside would have to deal with the fallout that they left behind. And it felt like this was like paintballs on steroids for them. Like, it was an adventure. It wasn't really about saving lives or about transformation. It was about like, it was an experience. It was simply an experience. And I see that then when you've had your experience, you go back to your location, you know, you go back to your, maybe to your suburb, maybe it's, you know, I mean, you know, maybe it's a trailer park, maybe it's a neighborhood, you know, whatever, but you go back to your life and you don't, your life's not on the line in the same way. So you just don't have the same kind of investment. And it's like, you don't have that lived body experience. So you are not able to really feel like you can't, like, for us, we can't get out of the experience of being black in an oppressive white supremacist society. We always feel it. We always are confronting it, and they just aren't.
Do you have something to add to that, Chris?
I do. And I'm kind of like thinking about how to enter into it, because mm-hmm. I think there's a way that we can look at this current conversation as if this is the first time that we're having this conversation. But it's not, right?
Okay.
Like, if you think about even the civil rights movement, right? and the whole conversation about white folks, non-black folks, participation in civil rights. Like, think about someone like Bernie Sanders and the way he like calls up his past of like marching with Dr. King and, you know, like the Freedom Rides. And like, there are these radical histories of white solidarity with, I mean, they're few, they frankly are few and far in between in the scheme of things, but they do exist, right? Like, people who've actually died for the cause. You can think about even further back, the movement against slavery, right? The struggle against slavery. And there were white abolitionists.
John Brown.
John Brown, like, let's be clear, if you want some John Brown's, like, type of time, you know, we can talk. But there were a lot of non-John Browns, uh-huh. right? There were a lot of folks, and there were similar conversations then about white folks' commitment, the way they might take up space that could be and should be reserved for the people who are most affected, conversations about power. So anyway, I want to like recall those histories, right? And there's a specific part of that history that's about like white folks who we know are the greatest beneficiaries of white supremacy and capitalism. But then there's also another conversation about non-black people of color, so to speak. There's another kind of dynamic of folks who have experienced oppression, who are not white, but who have different levels of proximity to that. And so that's all, that history is all there. Mm-hmm. Then we have this current moment, and there's like different versions of that, right? Like, there's the conversation about white saviorism.
Okay.
Right? There's the conversation around like performative allyship. Like, you really, are you an ally? Are you a co-conspirator? Like, what does it mean to actually be an ally, right? And to show up and show out in a sustained way for folks, right? And so there are those kind of conversations. And I'll just say that I think it's very important for us to keep these conversations open. And there are a number of reasons why it is to our peril to not keep these conversations open. One reason is security.
Yeah.
One reason is security. We can look at COINTELPRO. We can look at the way that our liberation struggles have been co-opted, not just by non-Black people, but also by like members of our community who've been like planted by the state and the system. But that's a very real concern, right? Then we also have the issue of like, what does it mean to like do the work of liberating yourself? Right. And part of that liberation work is like an actual struggle, perhaps. Some of that is an internal struggle to remove the white supremacist that is made to exist in all of us.
And people as living in America.
As living in this world, in this white supremacist world. And so to rely on white folks, it can reproduce and reinforce that same like white supremacy. There's also just the reality that a lot of times when we are in multiracial spaces because of white supremacy, because of white privilege, people show up with a level of entitlement that is actually counter-revolutionary, that is actually counter to the reasons why they say they have shown up to support.
Yeah.
They take up a lot. They can take up a lot of freaking space. And then the last thing I just wanted to say is that I think there's a larger question that maybe we can explore around why it is okay and why it is not even just okay, but necessary for Black people in particular who are part of Black liberation struggles to unite internally across our many differences that exist globally, to like really understand that it is imperative for us to like exist and strengthen our bonds as a community. And some of that work, that's an in-house conversation.
That work needs to be done. We were talking about that when we, just last week we were talking about, you and I were talking about the violence that's happening with our community and the way people are treating each other and all of that. I think it's a really interesting point that you raise about the fact that these conversations need to happen. I don't want to upset anybody by talking about a topic that is uncomfortable for them because they may feel that we're talking about white people and white people have done these things. I don't want to insult anyone. My intention is not to insult people, but if people are insulted by this conversation, then they should probably look at what's going on,
right,
and recognize that they're being insulted by a conversation that is real, that actually is an important conversation to have because of the situation that people of color, Black people, everybody, have been put in, including some poor white people, right? Because of this quote unquote white supremacy. I hate saying white supremacy. We need to have a—
Why?
Because they're not supreme. Because they—
thank you. This is not— there's no such thing as supremacy and someone that have used and stolen and misused
everything. But that's not what white supremacy is talking about. I understand what you're saying.
I understand that. I just hate saying— I don't even want to give that any kind of credence or respect or even validation. White supremacy, that's like— that don't make sense to me.
Right, because for the average person, when you're hearing that, you're not unpacking it.
Exactly. Like for the people who don't understand that, for kids who hear it for the first time, white supremacy is like white is supreme. And until they— to me, it is— as the damage that it done is equivalent to saying Black on Black crime. Because it teaches you something before you have to learn what it actually is.
I don't want to dwell on this because, like, that's actually not, like, central to, like, what we're talking about.
This topic is different than that.
But yeah. I will say that I don't think Black on Black crime is doing the same thing that white supremacy is doing. Black crime—
not the actual physical act.
No.
The terminology.
I'm talking about the framing.
Just the words.
I'm talking about the framing. Black on Black crime is a complete distortion of the nature of crime, the nature of intracommunal harm. Like, because we don't say white on white crime, it exposes the lie of Black on Black crime, because that only exists and has currency because we've normalized, like, a Black pathology discourse. That is one thing,
yes,
right?
Yes.
White supremacy is a reality sense that—
okay.
I'm not saying that white people are supreme. You know me better than that. I wouldn't say that. But what I will say is that just like capitalism, just like these other overarching structures of oppression, the idea of whiteness as normative, the idea that white people are supreme, it is a reality. And it is a reality because of these structures, not because it in a vacuum is right, but because that is the byproduct of these millennia of structures to create a situation in which, like, that these are some of the conditions of our lives.
I understand that it is not putting them on a pedestal in terms of them actually being better or supreme or superior. Right.
All I wanted to say was this: white supremacy as a discourse is useful only to the extent that it allows us to name a problem, to name a psychological, a structural, it allows us to name a problem in a way that I do think is useful.
Okay. We're gonna come
Can
back.
Can I just say one thing? I understand and agree with with both of you, and I think my issue with the language— I think that, you know, I think of words. Like, you know, I was saying earlier to someone, spells are made of words, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the language that we use to define problems, to describe things, it has its own power and its own magic. And the word white supremacy, I think, feels similar to me as it does to you, because it— even though it is used to define and to describe a particular very real aspect of, like, the reality of what the current paradigm is, and this particular thing that exists in our current paradigm, that there is language that would more appropriately, I think, that would better identify it as a pathology.
Like what?
Maybe white pathologism. Pathology, or white.
But how does that name—
We're going to— listen, check this out.
Investment in whiteness.
Let's do this. This is a topic that I think a lot of people probably struggle with because of the wording and the terminology and their understanding of it. And you're coming at it from a very educated standpoint. And I think for me, I just hear it and it just doesn't sound right. You know what I'm saying? And I do have a level of education and understanding about it from an educational standpoint too. But before I got that, I didn't like it. So it was just like it, I don't like black on black crime. Same thing, white on white crime, but there's no black supremacy either. Right. So it's like, but we could do this. Listen, I'm going to mark out some time for us to have a deeper conversation about this and we can get into it. No. Okay.
I would rather not.
I say that because it's a conversation that sparks, questions and whatever, but whatever. Okay. You would rather not. Great. I just feel like
we had a conversation before and we got derailed on this exact point.
There you go.
If you remember.
There you go. There you go.
And so let's just agree to disagree.
Keep it 100.
But the point, I mean, and it's very interesting on this topic because we're talking about whiteness in our movement. And I think we've actually just modeled the way like whiteness, white discourses, the things that are associated with how whiteness operates in the world. It just took over our entire conversation. And that is actually a perfect representation of what we're talking
about. That's what that do. Yeah.
And I think that the thing is like for us to begin to embody where we want to go as opposed to where we are. Like I like to use the language that speaks from within the place of the future of that liberated mindset to embody it now, because that's how we get there. So building and using language that is speaks from the vision that we have that we're moving towards, as opposed to reinforcing what is already in place.
Okay.
So Yane still wants to talk about this, is what I'm taking away.
Well, I mean, okay. We go. I love it because I'm there.
I don't disagree with y'all.
Let's move on to a question that I had directly for you. Moving completely past this whole other thing that
y'all
we were just
done irked me.
I could tell.
You done irked me, but go ahead.
let's do this. I wanted you to tell me some of the differences of support that you've seen that changed over the last year. Okay.
Where do we
bring it close? Bring the mic close. Talk about it.
Let me bring the mic.
Bring it close. Hit the elbow.
So I can say what I need to say.
Okay.
Well, I think just even in the course of last summer, the number of people who were willing to put their physical bodies on the line, mm-hmm. it declined, right? I think when we look at like that first month, there were a lot of people. Like here in Philly, we had actions that had like over 100,000 people, mm-hmm. right? That didn't last long at all. And it's not to like cast aspersions on that or to throw shade on that, because we who are organizers understand that that's how that go. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like that's how that
yeah,
go.
They there come are, in waves, there, it comes and goes.
There
yeah.
are ebbs and flows, but sure. it's also telling how those ebbs and flows work. What brings people out, what doesn't bring people out, what keeps people engaged, what doesn't keep people engaged. So like one, that kind of like physical tangible support declined pretty, there was a very quick drop off, right? Another thing that changed is that in the very beginning, there seemed like a pretty tight window where we were actually entertaining radical visions, right? We were talking about abolition. We were talking about
defunding the police.
People were talking about tearing this motherfucker down.
Prisons.
There was, you want to talk about like radical horizons, like you were talking about earlier. Like there was a moment where that felt like it was happening and we were able to engage with people at that level.
Right.
But then
what happened?
There was an election cycle.
So now I was wondering about that, like, because I wonder if a lot of the people that were out there because of the election. I wonder if a lot of the people were out there because of the pandemic, right? There was a lot of people that were sitting at home because they didn't have jobs, and that probably swelled a lot of the numbers.
I think the pandemic was more of a factor than the election at first. Like, I think people were sincerely showing up because of what we witnessed or heard of with George Floyd's murder. And just like after all that time in the pandemic, after all of the ways like we've sacrificed and seeing the police continue to like kill Black people again and again, like in 4K, you know, like that activated something that I think was very genuine. However, I think as we settled into like the long process of struggle, right? Like, and this is where organizing gets hard, mm-hmm. right? Like when you are in a meeting, you in a 12th meeting, right? When we're not in that uprising moment, like that's when like people often like show their commitment and their endurance in the struggle. And I think that some of that happened, but then I also think there was a lot of understandable like fear and anxiety about 4 more years of Trump. And so there were a lot of compromises that people
were willing to make
in the name of pragmatism, in the name of the lesser of two evils. But that pushed us away from that radical horizon that seemed like it was more possible than 6 months before that.
Do you think that some of these people that never got kettled with those rubber bullets had anything to do with it? I asked that question because, you know, if you're a college student or some kid who just want to follow your friend or get involved in something because a lot of people is involved in it, whatever, you may not know this world really. Right?
That's real.
You know what I'm saying? So I just wondered about that. Yane, Crystal made an interesting point about this thing about these meetings. If I never do another Zoom meeting, I'll be good. And when you get into these worlds that are different than just going out there and protesting, walking with the sign and going home and talking about it with your friends, when you got to actually sit behind these computers and organize and Google Doc and Google Invite and all of that stuff that most people don't really want to do. I know I don't. Mm-hmm. Do you think that had a big impact on discouraging the people that were out there?
I mean, my first thought when you were saying, when you said it, when y'all were talking and a person being hit by a rubber bullet for the first time, I definitely was thinking that that could be very discouraging. Like, you know, I mean, white people was getting fucked up, you know, and I think that they've walked around with, you know, there's a culture of entitlement that is a part of, you know, the white community that would make them not imagine that they would have the kind of experiences that they had, you know, when they decided to stand up for Black lives, that I think could have made people very easily be like, whoa, like, is this really
some other shit?
Yeah, is this really what I'm supposed to be doing out here?
Last time the cops came and told me something, they just told me to stop speeding or something, but they ain't hit me upside
right,
the head
and put tear gas like directly up my orifices. But I do think that when it comes to like the actual work of organizing, like a lot of people don't want to do that. Like that's a lot of work, you know, like we sit up for hours and hours and we spend days upon days and we are separated from, you know, our personal lives and our family members and our personal, you know, goals and aspirations and dreams in order to contribute to the fulfillment of our collective dream for collective freedom. And, you know, and I don't know that a lot of people have the wherewithal or the interest in making those levels of sacrifices from any communities, even those who are actually living in the worst struggles and situations. And so for, you know, people who don't live it and who can, when they go home, they're not even seeing it. And the only time you see it is in a video that's getting circulated. And after a while, you know, you become desensitized to that. You know, I think that, yeah, that is discouraging. It's not a space that everybody wants to contribute to. And then in those spaces, there is, going back to like the original subject of like white people and Black movement spaces, you have a place mm-hmm. when you're in those spaces. And if you're moving into or going into a movement space that's a Black movement space, your place is not in the front. And if you are a white person who is accustomed to being entitled to certain kinds of privileges of where your voice is elevated and, you know, and those sorts of things, and then you're in a space where you need to sit down and listen and
what difference
take the lead.
What difference does it make who leads?
I mean, that makes a big difference to most people. People want, like, a lot of people get involved in movement work in order to experience their magnificent leadership, you know? So a lot of people are like, I am, you know, I'm the white Malcolm X, you know?
Whoa,
you know, people jump up in
this
jump.
Hold up. No, pump those brakes.
People get into these spaces feeling ready.
No, you can't just do that like that. Hold up. Stop the car. Stop the car. This car is traveling. We got to stop it. The white Malcolm X. Stop. No, come on now. All right. Look, it may seem like we've only been talking for 5 minutes, but we're going to have to come back and, you know, continue this conversation, because it's a big conversation. Let's stop this right now. And next week, we're going to come back and we're going to continue the conversation. All right, folks, that's a wrap. Thanks to my sister and the one and only Pam Africa for getting on the Move with Mike Africa Jr. And to all the listeners who have tuned into this episode, if you like what you heard, tell a friend, let them know about the On the Move with Mike Africa Jr. podcast, and make sure you're following the podcast so you never miss an episode. Till next week, on the move. Peace out.